Ring the Baker, the Butcher, the Charioteer. Written by Calypsid and read by K-Verb. This is a Mass Effect fic, rated general audiences, in which no archive warnings apply. It features the relationship between Shep slash Garrus and is tagged with alternate universe regency, stagecoach, flirting, and unladylike behavior. This is part one of Little Light. Garrus looks out the stagecoach window at the round green hills, gently rolling away into the purple haze of the evening that follows the coach with quick, light steps, like the Ciaris priestesses dancing their obeisance to their goddess. It's so alien to him. Everything here has been an adjustment that he hadn't been prepared for. He hadn't known to expect it, not when this is his first posting outside of the homeland. His elders had told him, and a friend on the staff of the previous ambassador had tried to warn him, but he'd been too excited to really take it in. The first week, Garrus was so homesick he thought he might die. He'd toughened up, of course. Not for nothing is he the son of Castus and Talia Vicarin. But as he looks across the fields and the hills, at the grasses and trees and hedges the humans like to scatter all over the place, some part of Garrus is excited to be going home, to Palavin, where the heat embraces him like his mother's arms, where the plants have to fight just as hard as every other kind of life just to survive, where beauty is scarce and fleeting and can only be found by those who are looking for it. He's headed home for a personal visit. His sister is finishing basic training, and he'd been granted leave for her commencement. This is the only line that makes the run to the Turian border, and their coaches are specially outfitted with horses that have been bred for size and phlegmatic nature. On the other side of the border, Garrus will board one of their coaches, with the lizard-like Appiani harness three abreast, and enjoy a much, much smoother ride to the capital city of Palavin. That means everyone in this coach is headed to the border, too. The small, well-dressed Turian woman Garrus pegged as a spy the moment he laid eyes on her. But there are several humans on the coach as well. He looks at each of them in turn, trying to guess their business. The older man is wearing the white collar of the more prevalent church in this area. They've had so many schisms and religious wars and secessions that it's hard for him to keep track of which one this is. He thinks this area split off from the Catholics on the other continent at some point, which makes them Protestants. Or are they Anglicans? Isn't that the root word for English? Do they have to make it so hard on outsiders? There is a small church in Palavin for the embassy staff and a very few local converts, though, so maybe he's headed there with the latest news and religious proclamations. Is that how it works? It's another day to the border and then three more to Palavin after that. He might ask at some point just to satisfy his curiosity. Garrus turns his eyes to the other human man. He's younger, larger, and more active than the first man. He's been shifting in his seat, too, like he wants to stretch out his legs, but he's frustrated by the close, cramped quarters. Maybe Garrus is projecting. The coach was made for human passengers, not Turian, and Garrus could swear he's losing circulation in his legs. Garrus thinks he's either the spoiled younger son of some landowner, too good for working with his hands, but not rich enough to buy himself a commission, or he was in the military but was discharged before he served his time. His energy is the kind that is frustrated and looking desperately for an outlet. The human woman is chatting amicably with the other Turian in his own language. Her vocabulary is rather basic, the conversation stilted, but she's making an effort to learn the parts that humans can reproduce, which is more than he can say for most of them. And if he has to hide a quick smile when her lack of sub-vocals turn her meaning to something crude, it's nothing she should be ashamed of. Who is she, to have learned a language so unsuited to her own tongue? The human introduces herself as Miss Shepherd, to which the spy gives her name as Kandros. Garrus thinks that might even be her real name. He'd served with a Kandros on the Resolute. Shepherd is joining her brother at the embassy in Palavin, where he is the ambassador's chief secretary. When Kandros compliments her on the progress with the language, she says she's only been learning it for a few months. Garrus eavesdrops on their conversation until the next change of horses, about half an hour later, when the younger man decides to sit up front with the coach driver where he can get some fresh air. The religious man has put his head back and now he's snoring, which made Shepherd smile, her long and mobile mouth changing the shape of her face into something different, something unexpected. It fascinates him unreasonably. About 2 hours later, Garrus wakes up from a light doze when the coach jolts sharply and drives his head directly into the door. The bright burst of pain wakes him very nicely, though he could have done without it. He groans, bracing his arms against the seat and the wall to steady himself against the continued sharp rocking. The priest is on the floor, not cold, and the women are holding on to each other. Something has gone very wrong with the coach. "What is it?" he shouts over to Kandros, who shakes her head.
"I don't know."
"That idiot pitched the driver off," Shepherd says in her own language, her voice grim. "I saw him come off the box and go tumbling into the field a moment ago." Garrus looks at her, dread in his heart. And the odds that he knows how to handle a team of four? Shepherd looks back, her mouth pressed tight, her lips white. That's all she needs to say. If the horses have their head and they're running, they'll tire themselves out soon enough. That's not the problem. The road in this area isn't crowded, but they've passed enough other vehicles that the risk of overturning someone else, or being overturned themselves, is higher than he'd like. And that's to say nothing of the condition of the road, which is evident from the way the wheels are jouncing in ruts that should have been graded smooth long ago. Even if they don't meet anyone else, one bad bounce and the coach will tip over and smash into the road. And unless someone is right there to cut the horses away, even after the crash, they'll drag it down the road for miles in their terror. Garrus has seen the aftermath of a stagecoach crash. It's not pretty. "Someone has to go out there," Shepherd says, her face still set. She looks from Kandros to Garrus and nods once, sharply, and sits up. She offers her hand to Garrus, who takes it, very confused. She turns his hand over, snatches his glove off, and uses his talons to rip slits into her skirt to the knee, exposing pale silk stockings and shoes he can only call sensible. She lets him go then, but he's left with the after impression of her hand on his, taking exactly what she wants from him like he doesn't loom 2 feet taller than her, like he's not one of the species that hunted hers in the dark time immemorial. Shepherd takes a breath, and then she turns to the door and flings it open, where the wind takes it and flattens it against the outside of the coach. Only then does it strike him what she's doing. She's already halfway out the door when he takes her elbow. "You're going to fall," he says urgently. The mental image of her smashed against the road is too strong for him to dismiss, too disturbing to let her go. "Someone has to do something, and neither of you can do it," Shepherd points out. "You'll scare the horses even more. Just..." She glances out of the door at the road. "If you're so worried, don't let me fall." "I won't," Garrus promises, and then can do nothing but watch, his hand outstretched, as she carefully climbs out of the door and onto the side of the coach, picking her way across the brass fixtures decorating the side. She's slow, pausing every time the coach rocks. Is it his imagination, or is the rocking even more exaggerated now that Shepherd is clambering around on the outside? Garrus glances in at Kandros, who is trying to attend to the preacher. They're both in the middle of the compartment, and with Garrus's weight on the very edge of the door, the coach is as unbalanced as it is possible for it to be. "Move him to the other side," he tells Kandros. "The weight." She understands immediately and quite literally picks the human up off the floor with a display of strength that only confirms his initial impression of her. The man's in good hands, he thinks. And then they both immediately disappear from his mind as he turns his attention back to Shepard. Garrus braces himself in the open door of the coach, his feet pressing against the seat to keep himself in place, and watches Shepard like a hawk, wincing when her foot slips from the brass rod she's resting most of her weight on. He wants to call out to her, but he knows he shouldn't distract her. Biting his tongue, he watches, his heart in his throat, as she sidles across the rod, clinging to the forward lantern. She carefully maneuvers her body around the lantern fixture and reaches around the corner for the front passenger seat. Garrus tenses, his arm stretched towards her, ready to snatch her from midair if he has to. But Shepard shifts her weight around the corner as easily as if she's been doing this all her life. She pulls her arm and leg after her, and then she's gone, out of sight, and safe. Garrus sighs in relief. Even if the coach tips over now, she's in the best position to survive. She has something to hang on to. The worst place to be is here, in this compartment, with its tight and compact space surrounded by hard walls and numerous breakable windows. Garrus looks over at Kandros again, offering her a single nod, which she returns. He doesn't move from his position in the open door. He'd rather be thrown than smash his head through the window. Garrus thinks he can hear a trace of arguing on the wind, like Shepard is fighting with words, and then Garrus ducks backward as someone is thrown from the box into the verge. Dark clothes, rather large, it wasn't Shepard. Then the snap and jingle of the reins. The coach begins to slow almost at once into a more normal speed. Shepard must have regained control over the horses, thank all the spirits. She brings them down slowly from their headlong gallop through a trot and into a slow walk before letting them rest. Garrus is already jumping out of the coach before it even comes to a full stop. He catches the strap and swings himself up into the passenger box. The horses are too blown to run at the scent of him on the wind, but they stomp and snort threateningly anyway, just in case he decides to come closer. Garrus has eyes only for Shepard. She's sitting in the driver's box, her feet braced on the bar in front of her and the reins wrapped around her fist. Her hair is coming down from the neat knot at the back of her head. Her gloves are gone. There are runs in her stockings and a bloody mark on her face. But she grins at him anyway, wild and free and so proud of herself that he's helpless to do anything except grin back. He lifts his hand to touch the mark on her face, but thinks better of it and drops his hand again. He hit you.
He didn't think woman could drive, Shepard says, rolling her eyes. As if I couldn't do better than what he was doing. He's the one who whipped the horses into a frenzy when he didn't have control of the reins. So he had to go, I'm afraid.
Remind me not to underestimate you, Garrus says, his smile growing. She looks at him with laughing eyes.
Is that going to be a concern? Are we continuing our acquaintance after this journey?
Garrus offers her his hand to help her down from the box. Miss Shepard, it would be a shame if we didn't. The end.